Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's been a pretty big couple of weeks for Amazon.com. First, President Obama chose one of the company's fulfillment centers for a speech touting his economic and jobs policy. Then the news broke that Amazon's founder, the billionaire Jeff Bezos, had purchased the venerable Washington Post. Amazon now has 126 million monthly users. Some contribute feedback on products and books they buy, lending the huge online marketplace a kind of neighborly legitimacy and opening it up to the deceitful practice of astroturfing. Mike Masnick is founder and CEO of Floor 64 and editor of the Tech Dirt blog. He weeded through a series of reviews for a book by Susan Crawford that criticized the telecom industry. Mike discovered that the bogus reviews had a lot in common besides an agenda. His expose of the Amazon AstroTurf bomb reached the front page of Reddit. Mike, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Give us a little on the origins of AstroTurfing, which I had heard of in the political field.
It's just this idea of trying to pretend that there's a grassroots movement behind something. Certainly in some cases there have been very powerful grassroots movements that have been able to do all sorts of useful things politically and otherwise. But in recent years, political campaigns and lobbyists have realized that there are benefits to faking a grassroots movement, and that got the name astroturfing.
When did this faking practice start making its way into the Amazon market?
That we really don't know. There's been talk of fake reviews on Amazon, probably since the beginning, when you have friends and family writing reviews of books and things. But to the extent where there's a political effort behind it and probably some lobbyists, we don't really know when that started. Really only just discovered this one, recently.
I guess the fake reviews for, say, the Three Wolf Moon t-shirt on Amazon or the banana slicer became famous, not through some organized effort, but just because everybody wanted to sort of jump in on the action. What's the difference in that and this kind of comment astroturfing?
There have always been people just sort of having fun, finding an amusing Amazon product and writing reviews about it because it's fun or silly. But this, where there's a direct political campaign and a direct purpose behind it, is clearly driven by a large company or a few large companies to try and influence policy. That's different, and that could have a much bigger impact. I mean, they're really trying to diminish the impact of a book, which is a fairly important book on the discussion in this case about the telecom industry.
Well, tell us more about Susan Crawford's book. Where is she coming from, and who has an interest in tarnishing the book's reputation, I guess?
So her book is an interesting book. I don't necessarily agree with all of it, but it really takes a very critical look at today's telecom policy and telecom structure in the U.S. and suggest some pretty significant policy changes that would very much diminish the power of the telcos. I mean, as it stands today, we have very, very little competition in the broadband space. Most people, if you want to have a broadband connection in your home, you have really one or two choices. And both she and I find that to be problematic, certainly. And she thinks that the telcos are very much to blame, and there are some limitations that should be put on what they can do and some other things that the government can do to encourage much more competition. The telcos obviously don't like that.
How do you know that the reviews of her book were part of an organized astroturfing campaign?
Well, it's one of those things where you certainly get a sense of it as soon as you start reading the one-star reviews. They all felt a little off just reading them. And so, what I really tried to do was go through and see if there was some sort of systematic way to check those. And there were a couple indicators that Amazon gives you as to whether or not a review is more trustworthy or not. So what I decided to do was actually compare all of the one-star reviews to the five-star reviews, figuring there's a good comparison group. And when we compared those two things, it became very, very clear very, very quickly that, most of the five-star reviews certainly look like they were from real people, whereas the one-star reviews, almost all of them, they were the only review that person had written. They weren't verified purchase. They didn't have a real name. And even the text itself was so obviously fake. They always sounded kind of folksy. So here's a good example. There's a comment from someone named Lavelle Martin, and it says, "I am a professional truck driver who uses the internet in job training. I have just read the book Captive Audience by Susan Crawford. I am very disappointed in her negative attitude toward our national telecommunications system." It's It's things like that. It's just the reference to the truck driver. You know, I don't know any truck driver. I don't know any person who refers to it as our national telecommunications system. Here's another one from N. Hunter. It says, I do much of my schoolwork online and do not believe that Susan Crawford's points in captive audience are valid. I am from a rural area, yet my broadband connection is good enough for me to stream online lectures and perform research. You know, it has this sense like maybe it's kind of real, but just mentioning that I'm from a rural area, these are not things that you see in normal reviews. People don't talk about the nature of where they're from or what their job or that they're a student.
Any evidence of where they came from or which specific groups were putting people up to this?
That's not clear in terms of who actually put them up to it or who did it. There are a number of organizations, you know, mainly focused in the Washington, D.C. area that sort of specialize in these kinds of things. There are a number of different front groups, especially around the telco space. They've certainly put a lot of money into this kind of thing before. Some of the reviews on the site that were named did come from people who are associated with different groups that are generally considered front groups for the telcos, but there's no indication that the faked reviews came from any of those groups specifically.
Has Amazon done anything to either prevent or discourage or maybe even tag reviews suspected of astroturfing?
They've done a little bit. When it gets really extreme, they'll take action. They do allow you to check a box as to whether or not a certain review is helpful, which certainly does impact kind of how the reviews appear or if they appear at the top of the list. Amazon lately has also been doing a lot more to encourage verified purchasers and the use of real names within reviews, and I think they're going more and more strongly in that direction. But, you know, for the most part, I don't know that that's really working so far.
Mike Masnick, founder and CEO of Floor 64 and editor of the Tech Dirt blog. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You can read Mike's expose on Amazon astroturfing. We have a link at wordofmouthradio.org. A surprising email hit my inbox this week. It came from Tom Holbrook, co-owner and manager of the independent River Run Books in Portsmouth, one of our partners for the Writers on a New England Stage series. The subject line of Tom's email, Why I'm Not Going to Complain About Amazon Anymore. And it was sent to the more than 2,500 members of River Run's email list. Word of Mouth senior producer Rebecca Lavoie tracked Tom down to find out what was behind it. Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
I think we're pretty used to hearing independent booksellers complain about Amazon, but you've decided you're not going to complain anymore. Why is that?
Well, of course I'm going to complain. I mean, it's a bit of a rhetorical flourish to say I'm not going to complain and then complain. But it is true that there's a lot of pushback. You were just talking about fake reviews on Amazon. There's also the deadly, deadly comment section of blogs and anything that's posted online. And one of the things that I've noticed is when booksellers say, hey, Amazon's doing this terrible thing, more and more there's people who jump on and say, you know, just shut up. I want my books. I want them cheap. What makes you special? I think we have to, you know, go out there every day and show why we're special.
Well, you actually run through some of what you can do to, you know, not necessarily compete with Amazon, but certainly coexist a little more peacefully. You know, talk about some of those things. One of the things that you say is, you know, being more real world convenient. What does that mean for your store?
Well, all independents have been working over the last decade to be more convenient. We didn't used to have to be because we were the place where you got books. And now it's so much easier to whip out in your phone and order a book. And at the same time, there's more and more books being published every year. So, you know, my store is about 1,700 square feet. But if I were a 35,000 square feet Barnes & Noble, I still probably wouldn't have what you wanted because there's so many books. And since people can no longer just walk into a store and assume that they're going to have what they want, we've got to do everything we can to get that book to them instead of having them go elsewhere. One of the more interesting trends I've seen is that people are choosing format based on availability. And that is a surprising thing to me. Let me explain. Someone will come into the store and say, do you have The Grapes of Wrath? And I say, no, can I get one for you? And they say, no, I'll just download it to my iPad. Now, if I had had the book, they would have bought the paper book. But since I didn't have the paper book, they were going to get the electronic book. And I think we're used to thinking of people as either people who like e-readers or people who like paper books, but that's really not the case at all. So one of the things that we need to struggle to do is to help that person get that book from us. And that may be explaining to them that they can order the ebook from us just as easily, or explaining to them that they can order the paper book from us and have it delivered straight to their house. Whatever, there's a lot of things that we can do that I don't think consumers realize that we can do. We need to be, you know, cutting edge and also sort of preserve the feel of bookselling that draws a lot of people into our physical stores.
I'll admit, I shop on Amazon. I think of Amazon more now as a place to buy, say, you know, dog food, or, you know, the brand of moisturizer that is hard to find and I can get it with free shipping with Amazon Prime. And, you know, buying books, like you mentioned, sometimes in terms of format, the download is easy if you want something right away. But you're sort of talking about bringing back the value of the high touch experience. Is that enough to have this conversation, that for people to make this conscious choice? You know, we're not going to sell dog food or car batteries or road salt here. You know, come in for this high-touch experience because of the experience.
Right. And that's part of where Amazon is so frustrating. And one of the reasons you hear booksellers complaining, and it makes us sound like six-year-olds, but it's not fair. You know, they're selling dog food and TVs and such, and what they're really trying to do is capture information from people that they can use down the road. They, to my knowledge, and they're very secretive about their bookkeeping, but to my knowledge, they do not make a considerable amount of money selling books. They use books to get people to the site to sell them other things. And again, they don't show their numbers to everybody, so I can't say for 100% that that's true. But most booksellers, you know, we just sell books. And I think people would be upset if we sold dog food. You know, I mean, part of our job and part of the trick is to help people make that connection that if I want to continue having this tactile experience, I need to buy the books where I'm having that experience. And the point of my email was basically to say, there's a whole lot of you out there who already get it. And thank you. We really, really thank you. And know that we're always trying to make the experience better. And I would rather spend my time cementing that relationship and improving it than chasing the people who are going to run around just looking for the cheapest price.
So instead of preaching to the choir, you're just going to change the sermon and maybe grow the choir a little bit.
Right. I'm going to continue to preach to the choir. And the hope is through the technology that we have now that the choir will help me grow the choir.
Man, he's a window shopper. Mad at me. I think I know why.
Tom Holbrook there, co-owner and manager, River Run Books in Portsmouth. You can read the full text of the email he sent to his customers called Why I'm Not Going to Complain About Amazon Anymore on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. One in 13 people on Earth use Facebook. It is a staggering number, and evidence of the human desire to connect with others through social media. Research at the Human Computer Institute at Carnegie Mellon and other places have found that passively following the lives of others on Facebook can have the opposite effect, triggering feelings of depression, envy, and isolation. Jessica Winter is senior editor at Slate. She argues that the hipster-centric photo-filtering social network Instagram is even worse. Jessica, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
If we're to believe the intention of Facebook and Instagram, social media is about connection. Yet there are all these findings about really negative feelings. Why is that?
What this all comes down to is really how we use social media. There are a million different ways of using Facebook. You know, we can use it for one-on-one conversations with friends. We can engage in political debate with a selected group of people. You can play games. You can sign and circulate petitions. You can use your news feed as more or less an RSS feed. And so if your version of Facebook is creating this kind of diverse ecosystem of communication, then chances are, and the research bears this out, that Facebook is going to improve and enhance your life. It's going to improve and enhance the connections that you're making. What these studies have been looking at, and I feel like every 6 months or so, there's another study that comes out, and usually the popular press presents it as, oh my God, Facebook is ruining our lives. What they're looking at very specifically is what they call passive following or passive consumption of Facebook. If you are mostly on Facebook to occasionally update your status, occasionally hit like on something. But, you know, for the most part, you are a passive follower. You're scrolling through your feed. You're scrolling through people's beautiful vacation pictures and their romantic sunset honeymoon shots and their beautiful meals at expensive restaurants. Then, yes, the chances are somewhat better that Facebook is going to make you feel bad in any number of ways. It's going to intensify your feelings of detachment from people, of alienation. There was a study out of Germany that talked about envy and resentment and how passive following on Facebook can intensify those sorts of feelings. There was also a study out of Utah, and I wrote it down so that I would have it exactly right because it's kind of self-explanatory. They are happier and having better lives than I am. The impact of using Facebook on perceptions of others' lives. So these are real findings. They're peer-reviewed, controlled studies, but it's important to point out that they are looking at very specific kinds of uses of Facebook.
What makes Instagram so much worse in your mind?
So Instagram, I would venture, purifies the more negative aspects of Facebook. You are posting photos, you are liking and commenting on other people's photos, you are scrolling through other people's narratives of their lives. And so arguably, the Instagram experience purifies these strains of the Facebook experience that researchers have found most troublesome.
Because we're looking at photographs instead of reading people's, you know, sincere comments about their day or interactions with other people, and photographs that are filtered, you know, to look just perfect.
Oh, absolutely. You edit and curate an idealized portrait of your life. You choose the most flattering angles and the most serendipitous moments of your life, and you invest a lot of time doing that. And you recognize on a rational level that other people are doing that too, but it's sort of hard to think that in the moment. And it would also be kind of churlish and horrible to think that in the moment, right? Oh, they're smiling and looking happy in that photo, but I bet they're secretly miserable. I mean, no one, it would be kind of crazy to think that. So what we end up thinking is that everyone has these idealized lives. And if we're not engaging in this form of social media in a way that's very proactive, if it becomes kind of passive, then that can result in these sort of negative effects that research has shown us.
I have to say, I'm a little bit more intimidated about using Instagram for some reason. Is this why? Because it's a sort of, it's all the worst elements of Facebook?
Again, it depends on how you use it. I have friends who are on Instagram who only follow celebrities. So what they end up with is a kind of curated, personalized version of Us Weekly, and they enjoy it very much. I have a friend who follows exactly 16 people on Instagram, and those 16 people are the only people who are allowed to follow her. And so what she ends up with is a carefully controlled, shareable family and friends photo album. So, you know, I think it's useful to think in structured ways about how we're using this stuff and how this stuff may or may not affect us.
What's the role of sort of stalkerism here on Instagram?
One of the researchers that I spoke with for this piece, Nicole Ellison from the University of Michigan, she coined this phrase when I was talking to her, the gray line of stalkerism. And she was talking about how you run more of a risk of violating the gray line of stalkerism than Facebook. Because, again, there are so many different things that you can share on Facebook. And if you saw someone's Facebook update about, I don't know, a news story that they were interested in, you could see yourself approaching that person at a party and talking them up about it. But if you follow someone on Instagram and you were looking at their romantic sunset honeymoon shots or something, and you, oh, hey, I'm Jessica. I saw your pictures on Instagram. They might think you're really weird. I mean, people have chosen to share their lives with you in this way, but it's still kind of weird.
Maybe all this research suggests that our response to images is so much stronger than all of the other parts of us.
Yes. I mean, Hannah Krasnova, again, one of the researchers with the German study, says this. She says, you do not envy a status update. You envy a picture.
Jessica Winter, senior editor at Slate, thank you so much for joining
us.
You can link to her article, Here's Why Instagram is Even More Depressing Than Facebook. We have a link to it at wordofmouthradio.org. More word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of mouth.
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 Well, das mut.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. At 5 feet tall and 90 pounds, Georgia Leap is tiny in stature, but commands a long shadow on the streets of Los Angeles. She's a professor of social welfare at UCLA and an anthropologist who traces the kinship ties, rights, turf wars, and intervention programs operating in the bloodiest trenches of L.A. Her book, Jumped In, is part memoir and part ethnographic narrative of gang culture from a woman who's earned props among gang members, respect from academics, and from law enforcement. Jumped In is now out on paperback. I spoke with Georgia when it was first released and asked her how she got her start studying gangs.
Well, you don't show up and just say, hey, I'm here to study gangs, obviously. And what happened with me is I had been a social worker in South Los Angeles and knew the fathers and mothers and grandfathers and grandmothers of some of these folk and sort of connected with them, got to know them, and they introduced me into the community. I didn't show up alone, and I always had somebody to vouch for me.
Well, that's one of the things that we see in your book. Some of these are like third-generation narratives, you know, really looking at the roots. And we get really a sort of ethnography of clan mentality and kinship ties and initiation and sexual rights and language rights or different language. Now, how do you approach this or go beyond a conventional ethnography when you're looking at something like gang culture? Or did you go beyond that?
I think the very first thing that enabled me to do this more than anything was to understand how I identified and how there were points of similarity between myself and these folk. And some of them are not pretty. Some of them are not complimentary. I traditionally have had kind of a very bad temper. And I also came from a very extended clannish Greek family where there was a lot of, how shall I say, a lot of family feuding, a lot of love, but also a lot of sort of internecine warfare within the family. And all of this helped me in an improbable way to understand what I was dealing with in terms of gang culture.
Many of us have heard stories, you know, some of them are true, some we've seen movies, we've heard rap songs. Mm-hmm. The demonize gang members or glorify them, but scare us. And I'm wondering, after years of being immersed in this culture, do you want to challenge any of those stereotypes?
Well, that's really one of the reasons I wrote this book, because they are sensationalized. I cannot lie. I don't want to say that gang life is blissful or positive or they are overestimating the crime or the havoc that is wreaked. But I think there's an important distinction to be made between gang life and gangs in general and individual gang members. And when you drill down into the lives of individual gang members, you see a lot of variation, a lot of difference, and many, many lives that are very identifiable with our own. You know, if it bleeds, it leads, and sex sells, and, you know, the bloodier or the more violent, often the better at the box office. But I don't think this offers us a realistic picture of what is actually going on within gang life.
Well, let's get into some of these stories, then, of people who got jumped in. First, maybe you could explain that term to us, jumped in.
Jumped in is what's referred to as the gang initiation rite. And by and large, for men, it consists of being very violently beaten for a demarcated period of time, say even 15 to 30 seconds. And while that period of time sounds very short to us, the beatings are extremely violent. This is what happens with young men. With young women, it often involves sexually being jumped in by a number of sexual partners. And it's grisly and gruesome and very exploitive and violent, but in a different way than being beaten in.
I'm wondering about the role of women in this very violent culture. Obviously, you as a woman, you know, you write in the book about sort of being especially drawn in by those relationships.
Yes, and it was very difficult for me because, you know, the conventional wisdom was that women were baby mamas. Mm-hmm. They were the mothers of gang members' children, often in multiple numbers. However, the picture is much more complex because I discovered that there are women who are active gang members, who are shooters, who are drug dealers. But nevertheless, and I have to be very clear about this, there is still a two-tiered system. Women in gang life, whether Latino or African American, whether black or brown, are definitely the second sex. Mm.
You advise Lee Baca. He's now the L.A. County Sheriff, and you know and speak to a number of cops. You're actually married to a member of the LAPD. I'm wondering if that's complicated things for you.
Full disclosure, my husband did retire from the Los Angeles Police Department 5 years ago. I like to joke that he's in recovery. But nevertheless, I deal with law enforcement on a daily basis, and the relationships are fascinating and highly problematic. And the way around that is I am very, very candid about my connections. It's turned out for me to be the best way to be, although early on in the street, I later discovered that there were gang members who planted stories with me to see if I would tell my husband or tell the cops, and if in fact I was a snitch. And when I did not repeat anything, it sort of established my credibility, or at the very least, myself as being someone people could trust.
Uh-huh. One of the big surprises for me was that as far as getting out of gangs, you know, we hear how difficult that is, but it's actually people who are higher up in the hierarchy that can more easily leave the gangs. That was a little surprising to me. I would think they'd be bigger targets.
Well, there's two parts of the process. One is what I really learned is there is this mythology around how difficult it is to escape gang life or to be jumped out. And in my experience, that was mythology. What made it difficult was that people sabotaged themselves. They were afraid to leave. They felt secure within the gang, as much as, you know, as strange as that sounds. And when I say that shot callers had an easier time, here's the irony, and here's another huge thing I learned. They, shot callers, and those who were very high up in the gang hierarchy, were actually able to transfer their leadership and their business skills. And they really were business skills in running these drug distribution networks. They could transfer those much more easily into mainstream life than the lower level gang members who were soldiers and kind of in the streets. Leadership in the gang translates to leadership out in the mainstream world, and that was stunning to me.
That was my previous conversation with Georgia Leap, anthropologist and adjunct associate professor at UCLA. You can find out more about her book, Jumped In, What Gangs Taught Me About Violence, Love, Drugs, and Redemption. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
That's actor Bryan Cranston as Walter White from season 6 of AMC's hit TV series Breaking Bad, owning up to his wife about his prowess as a drug dealer. Breaking Bad follows a high school chemistry teacher who cooks up meth with a former student, kicking off a fast slide into murder, extortion, and unsavory partnerships as a bona fide drug lord. Too crazy to be true, right? Well, maybe not. In 2011, police in California arrested Stephen Kinsey, professor by day, outlaw biker, and meth distributor by night. Kinsey's been out on bail since his initial arrest. The preliminary hearing to determine whether or not the case against him is strong enough to go to trial was scheduled for June. It's since been delayed. Natasha Vargas Cooper wrote about the real-life Walter White for BuzzFeed. She's also a frequent contributor to The Atlantic and The New York Times, among other publications. And Natasha, great to have you with us.
Hi, thanks.
All right, so who is this Stephen Kinsey?
Stephen Kinsey is a pretty gregarious and well-liked professor at the University of San Bernardino, California, which is a desert suburb out here in Southern California. He had good ratings from his students. He taught kinesiology, which is the study of body movement. He had a master's and a doctorate. Some students complained that sometimes he would be late, sometimes he'd be a little disorganized, but in general, the reviews were very, very positive, even though he could be a little intimidating. And it makes a little bit of sense because when he wasn't at school, he and a former student who became his live-in girlfriend, named Holly, were suppliers to a mid-level meth distribution network. So he supplied about 3 to 4 street-level dealers with meth, and he was also part of the Devil's Disciples. They would call themselves a motorcycle club. The FBI calls them a motorcycle gang. And he wasn't just a part of the gang, he was the leader. He was the president, the local president of the Mountain Chapter of the Devil's Disciples. His nickname in that group, just like Walter White has Heisenberg, he has Skins. So Kinsey was known as Skins.
Apparently they had enough evidence to do a raid on his home. What did that turn up?
The raid turned up body armor, pistols, handguns, a pound of methamphetamine, and some biker patches, including one for his girlfriend Holly, that said property of Skins. And he wasn't just the only person arrested in the raid. Eight other associates were, from just dealers to buyers, and most of the buyers that were arrested were women. So everybody around him, eight other people were arrested, and I believe that six of them pleaded guilty. The only people who've pleaded not guilty to the charges are Kinsey, another higher-level dealer than him, and his girlfriend.
Pretty natural, you know, given this kind of setup, to compare him to Walter White on Breaking Bad, trying to suss out the other similarities. I mean, why did he get into this business? Was he also strapped for cash because of an illness?
Well, no, that's what was puzzling, is that, you know, there's a lot of chatter on education blogs of saying, you know, he wasn't tenured, but he lived in a very nice two-story split level in San Bernardino. He's a single guy. He had a good contract and had enough money to have a very expensive motorcycle. Now, I don't doubt that teaching at a mid-level college does not pay as well as being a meth dealer. But that's the one thing that people have found somewhat puzzling is, well, why not do one or the other? Why bother to do both? But it turns out he really liked teaching.
So what exactly has Kinsey been charged with?
He has been charged with the biggie is criminal conspiracy, as well as felony counts of intent to sell, manufacturing, and some weapons charges. Now, the question is, did these activities necessarily go to benefit the Devil's Disciples? Mm. Will there be a gang enhancement thrown onto the charges?
Oh, would that change the terms of the case, I imagine?
Yeah, that could add some serious time, and that hasn't quite been sussed out, and that still needs to be presented in the preliminary, and the judge could say no, because from what I've read from the wiretap, along with some very amusing text messages between Kinsey and his other associates saying, I'm low on study supplies, will you bring some top shelf stuff? And them saying, yeah, I have so much stuff, I might as well have a degree, LOL. He's pretty significantly involved, but it's unclear if any of this had to do with the Devil's Disciples, and if that is just maybe something he does on the weekends. Because they also do cookouts, they also have picnics. To them, they don't believe that they're a gang, they're a club that just happens to have a bunch of members who have felony backgrounds.
Sounds kind of entertaining, though. Do you think this Kinsey case would also make for good TV?
I think so, just because he seems to be such an interesting guy. And clearly, there's just something fascinating about anybody who is caught in a criminal underworld and then also has to grade papers. You know, that is instant television. I will say that a big difference, though, between Stephen Kinsey and Walter White is the level of caution. Mm. This was not a hard conspiracy to unravel. The text messages were very thinly layered. Onions are what they called meth. Soup is what they called, you know, a big supply. And even some people would text each other and say, do you have an eight ball? So they do really need a Skyler White to keep them. They needed a car wash. They needed a better story.
Clearly, he wasn't adopting the strategies and tactics of Walter White. Any indication that Kinsey was inspired by Breaking Bad?
I feel like this goes back way before it. And it is part of, unfortunately, it's very ingrained in the kind of desert suburbs that we have out here. Meth is huge, and biker clubs and gangs are very big. And, you know, what really predates what you see in Breaking Bad is biker meth. Bikers are who really brought meth to Southern California. So there's a long tradition that he is a part of.
Natasha Vargas Cooper, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
Natasha wrote about the real-life Walter White for BuzzFeed, and she's also the author of Mad Men Unbuttoned, a romp through 1960s America. We have a link to more on her book, the article, and the video clip we featured in the introduction. All that's at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter.
Word of mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. It may not be perfect, but technology for tracking and forecasting weather has advanced rapidly over the past few decades. Weather junkies who feast on meteorological sources and programs may be happy to know of a new frontier in weather reporting. Space. The United Kingdom's National Weather Service is partnering with NASA and the NOAA on an expanded forecasting center to provide space weather in near real time. We want to get a better idea of what a space forecast might sound like, so we called Joe Hansen, host and writer of the PBS Digital Studios' It's Okay to Be Smart. Hello, Joe.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
So on an average day, what does the weather look like in space?
When we talk about weather in space, we're really talking mostly about the sun. We now got to keep our eyes on meteorites and comet tails and things like that that we're flying through. But most of what we're looking at involves the sun. So when you look at the sun, we see this sort of rippling surface, these dark and light. Sometimes we see some sunspots, solar flares, or these super huge explosions called coronal mass ejections. And what these do is they eject billions of tons of matter, you know, protons and electrons towards the Earth, and a ton of radiation, everything from radio waves to gamma rays and X-rays and things like that. And so when those get to Earth, they interact with our magnetic field. See, the Earth's sort of like a big magnet. It's got a big core of molten iron, and it emits this field, this protective field, that's actually one of the reasons that we're alive down here and that we have an atmosphere. So when these charged particles, a few days later after being released from the sun, they strike that magnetic field, and they can disrupt our radio communications. They can mess with navigation systems. They can even turn little wires, the power lines above your house. They can force a big current shock to go through there and blow the circuit breakers. Famously, in 1859... there was this event called the Carrington event. An enormous coronal mass ejection was released from the sun. That hit Earth a few days later. The sky was glowing with auroras down to, you know, Italy, maybe as far as Hawaii and places like that. And they were able to power telegrams from Boston, Massachusetts to Portland, Maine, with the equipment unplugged. These are things that can happen at any time when the sun's weather gets a little angry.
Well, and there's much more at stake now than just telegraph wires.
If you like this radio station, if you like your mobile phone, if you like your computer, your wireless internet, if you like electricity in your house, you know, these are things you have to worry about.
What equipment do scientists need to be able to forecast space weather and to keep their eye on these coronas and other phenomena from the sun?
So NASA and their partners have some ground-based telescopes that looking at the sun. They've got some really cool telescopes that stare at the sun full time. And they're watching that area around the sun that we call the corona, which is the most magnetically rich, energy-rich, hugely, hugely hot area of the sun. So when we see a coronal mass ejection come out, they'll kind of plot our course and see if we're going to fly through that. There's also other satellites that are watching the surface of the sun, looking for things like sunspots, which can be kind of a precursor to solar flares and these active solar regions. So if one of those happens to be pointed right at the direction of the Earth, you know, we've got a few days' notice thanks to these eyes in the sky.
Science aside, it's the competition for the TV viewer that has driven a lot of advances in meteorology, at least how it's presented to the public. How do we get people interested in the weather in space?
Well, first of all, pictures of the sun are cool. So everybody likes going on and looking at these awesome animations and these videos that come off these satellites. I mean, some of the greatest pictures that have come from space in the past few years have been these enormous arcs of magnetic plasma that have come off the sun. I could stare at those all day, but, you know, that's me. The weather report sort of sounds like you would expect if you turn to that one channel on your TV where that robotic voice is sort of repeating it over and over. So just trust that there's a lot of trained specialists and interested scientists that are out there watching it for you.
Johansson, host and writer of the PBS Digital Studios, It's Okay to Be Smart. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Now you can learn much more about the future of space forecasting and find links to see Joe's blog and YouTube video series at wordofmouthradio.org. Maybe all it takes to get people more interested in space weather is to leave it to the pros. We wanted to know what it would sound like if NHBR decided to start adding space forecasts to our weather reports. Here's NHBR's Dan Colgan trying his chops as an astrometeorologist.
In outer space weather today, low solar activity, some minor crackling of C-class solar flares from departing sunspot AR1800, with a 10% chance of more substantial M-class flares. Overnight, a slight chance of visible meteor showers over the southern half of the planet. Potentially hazardous asteroid 2005 WK5 will not be colliding with Earth, but will be passing about 3,100,000 miles away. There's a 20% chance we'll see some minor geomagnetic storms in mid-latitudes. Solar wind is holding at 340 kilometers per second, though increasing wind from a coronal hole could make for more disturbances in the Earth's magnetic field over the next few days.
Among his day jobs, Davy Rothbart is creator of Found Magazine, which publishes lists and letters and photos and other discarded items. He's also a contributor to This American Life and the subject of the documentary film My Heart is an Idiot, which is also the title of his collection of essays. Davy is a tender, open-hearted wanderer who talks to strangers, runs with underdogs, and knows how to spin a tale. He's the kind of guy who says yes to just about anything. Well, you may not want to follow him into America's seedy underbelly, but it's a thrill to read about it. We spoke to Davy Rothbart last year when My Heart is an Idiot was first published. Davy, so glad you could join us.
Oh, it's great to talk to you, Virginia.
So you're on another cross-country tour. You live pretty much between L.A. and Ann Arbor, your hometown. Are you ever not on the road?
You know, the last couple of years, I took a break from the road. I was trying to finish the new book, and I was working on a new documentary film. And so I didn't tour around as much as I have, you know, the last 10 years. But this fall, my brother and I are doing a 79-city tour.
Whoa.
In 99 days. So we're just like 2 weeks into it.
It feels like you're always in motion. You know, I'm reading these narratives, some of your descriptions of that kind of gap when you run from suburban kind of ubiquity into the woods and begin to see places open up. And I think a lot of poverty and the banality of many American places. I know you teach writing. How do you get that momentum when you write?
Well, and you know, even in traveling, you know, I think what I love is just being open to new experience and the people that you'll meet once you start hitting the road. I was on my way to the Grand Canyon, and I saw this guy standing on the side of the road, 70 years old, silver-haired guy, hitchhiking, and I picked him up, and his story turned out to be just pretty cool. He was from Boston. He'd worked in a factory all his life, and his lifelong dream was to go to the Grand Canyon. Hmm. And he had always talked about it at work until the point, you know, the guys he worked with said, it's depressing. You're always talking about going to the Grand Canyon. You're never going to get there. And he said, I quit. Got on a bus a week later and had taken it as far as Amarillo, Texas, and was hitchhiking the rest of the way. So here's a guy whose lifelong dream is to get to the Grand Canyon. I'm lucky enough to pick him up for like the last 2 hours and help him, you know, deliver him to this dream spot of his. And it was a meaningful moment for me. And so that's one of the stories in My Heart is an Idiot. But for me, you know, I find whenever you're in motion, you're always crossing paths with strangers. And, you know, just like the Notes in Found magazine, you know, mm-hmm. meeting real people as you travel is special to me.
Yeah, but you say yes to it. You get into the truck with a guy wearing a Miller Time T-shirt, you know, to go get gas. You pick the silver-haired guy up. You talk to the 109-year-old man on a bus. I mean, do you just have to say yes to this stuff? Is that just how you do it?
Yeah, I think something Mr. Rogers talked to me about when I interviewed him for This American Life was the fearfulness we have of the people that we share the world with. And I think when you're open and open yourself a little bit, you know, good things happen. You alluded to, you know, getting a ride with the guy in the Miller Time shirt. Mm-hmm. This was the time I ran out of gas in Joshua Tree, kind of just in the middle of nowhere, no phone service or anything. You know, so what do you do in that moment? You can do what I did, which is, you know, hitch a ride and hope some friendly person picks you up. And, I ended up traveling with this interesting family, this former Marine and his family, you know, and it had sort of a fun adventure out of it. I don't know what the alternative is, really, you know. So I guess, yeah, I say yes, but I sometimes don't even know what the other options would be.
Yeah, I guess waiting for AAA wouldn't have that kind of luster. But you were there in the Joshua Tree, kind of, you know, you just spent a pretty great weekend with this woman. And there is this kind of hunger that goes throughout the book. You're kind of searching for love. Your ideal woman is Shade, a character from a film from the 90s, Gas Food Lodging. But there is this searching for love, finding love, and losing love that run through the essays. What is it about that cycle that has you repeating it over and over again?
You glimpse somebody, and it's so easy to fill in the blanks and, you know, idealize who that person might be. But I like to investigate those possibilities and, you know, see if this is somebody that could be a good match. And sometimes you find that, no, it's probably not. But other times, you know, you're rewarded. The woman that you mentioned in that story, Ain't That America, the British woman.
Anna, was it? I can't remember.
Anna. I'm going to see her today in about half an hour. So even someone like that who it didn't work out with romantically at the time, if people come into your life, maybe things don't happen that way, but maybe there's some other reason the universe has brought you together. Maybe there's some enduring friendship that comes out of it.
Well, she's a cosmopolitan woman from England, living in L.A., an author, a filmmaker. But I feel like a lot of this book is about, I don't know, kind of the other America, the people and characters you meet who are kind of down on their luck, where having a full tank of gas to get to work or a rent check means just about everything. And if you don't have that, it can really, really limit what you can do. Are you trying to sort of represent for that other America in any way, Davey?
Sure. I mean, those are stories I'm surrounded by, I feel like. And, you know, growing up in Michigan and, you know, you see what a lot of people in a lot of parts of the country are going through. I just spent a year in a small town in Indiana filming this documentary about this small town that, you know, the factories have shut down and things have grown dire. And you see how, you know, how tough it is for people and how much, one tank of gas, people living paycheck to paycheck. And frankly, I feel like those are stories that need to be told. In the new book, there's a story called Human Snowball.
And,
you know, I'd taken a bus to Buffalo to try to surprise
on
this girl.
On
Valentine's Day. Maybe putting a little too much pressure on the situation in the best of ways by her. But along the way, I met this guy who was 109 years old on the bus, a sort of old acquaintance of mine who was basically a car thief, and then his family that owns a Chinese restaurant. And, you know, for each of them, it was just one little thing, you know, in their life that they hoped would go right. And so it's really wonderful when, you know, people get beat up by life. But when one thing goes well, it's really fun to celebrate that, especially with a new tangle of friends.
Yeah, eventually there are about 8 or 9 of you in the car.
Roaming around Buffalo, each with their own small private mission.
Dented car, and that you eventually get stopped by the police and kind of get out of it. But I wonder about that. You know, as we get older, the lure of sleeping on friends' recliners or getting into stolen cars may leave us. I mean, is this stuff still happening to you? Are you imagining that this is how your life is going to unfold as you get older? You're a young man.
I'll say this. Yeah, maybe I'm 37. You know, maybe my adventurousness has been curbed back by 10-20% than 5 or 10 years ago when a lot of these stories happened. But I will say this. My instinct to engage with strangers has not been diminished. If somebody comes up to me on the street and has a question or if I, you know, I'm sitting on the bus. I live in L.A. I don't have a car. I walk, bike, and take the bus everywhere. And on the bus, people are friendly, and sometimes they'll, you know, start up a conversation with you or you'll start one up with them. And I have new people coming to my life every day. And that comes from traveling, but it also comes from just being open. And I think that's something I'll always continue to do, even if I'm no longer sleeping on floors or in the back of my van.
You pretty much lead with your heart. Would you have it any other way, Davey?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, sometimes you get, your heart gets beat up a little bit, but that makes you stronger. I believe that's true.
Davey Rothbart, I really want to thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's great talking to you.
There's a black man with black hair. Little blind man, he's got an interstate running through his front yard. You know, he thinks he's got it so good.
That was my earlier conversation with Davey Rothbart, author of My Heart is an Idiot and also creator of Found Magazine and a contributor to This American Life. We wanted to let you know that he'll be making a swing through New England this fall and reading at the River Run Bookstore in Portsmouth, New Hampshire on October 1st. We posted a link to his upcoming tour at wordofmouthradio.org.
You and me, ain't that America? Something to see, baby.
Thank you for your listening time today. We do welcome your feedback about the show. You can post a comment on our Facebook page. There are plenty of ways to listen to Word of Mouth. On our website, wordofmouthradio.org, you can also download a podcast of the show from iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher, or listen on the NHPR app. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us. Let us know what you're hearing. The best stories are told by Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
and Bill Barry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with plenty of help from our interns, Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public
Radio. You and